Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
While the military-trained astronauts of Apollo 11 walked on the moon in the summer of 1969 planting flags, the world back home seemed consumed by other things. The protests of hippies and activists and civil rights leaders. It was a study in opposites. Or was it? It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, Neil Marr talks about the social forces that shaped NASA in the 1960s and 70s, connecting the space race with the radical upheavals of the counterculture. Marr is a professor of history at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and Rutgers University, Newark. He's the author of Apollo in the Age of Aquarius. Neil Marr, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So on the day before the Apollo 11 launch in 1969, two leaders of the civil rights movement, Thomas Paine and Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, were at Cape Canaveral in Florida. I was wondering if you could explain why they were there.
Sure. Just to clarify, Thomas Paine was the head of NASA at the time. So he was not so much a civil rights activist, but someone who Ralph Abernathy was very much interested in meeting because Ralph Abernathy was Martin Luther King's right-hand man and the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And Abernathy had traveled to Cape Canaveral to, he said, not to protest Apollo 11, but instead to sort of draw attention to the nation's, quote, distorted sense of national priorities. And what Abernathy did was he arrived with 25 poor African-American families, four mules, and two old rickety wagons. And he asked Thomas Paine to meet him in the middle of a damp field outside the Kennedy Space Center with the Apollo rocket off in the distance. And he basically asked Paine to turn a lot of their technology around to sort of have the scientists work not only on getting the rocket to the moon, but also on problems back on Earth affecting poor African Americans. It's a pretty dramatic protest.
I was just thinking as we kind of roll forward towards the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, that there are so many books on Apollo, just hundreds. And this is a really interesting way of opening your book and kind of counterintuitive. And I was wondering why you decided to open the book this way.
I think that to me, what was interesting when I started thinking about the project was that that summer of 1969 was sort of interesting because on one hand, you had that launch, the Apollo 11 launch, where a million people from all over the country flocked down to Cape Canaveral to really celebrate the nation, to celebrate the fact that we were beating the Russians to the moon. And then a couple weeks later, 3 weeks later, you had 500,000 young people hitchhiking up to Woodstock, New York, to have a very different sort of gathering, right? It was quite critical of the country, especially with respect to Vietnam. And that criticism was told through music. And I thought, how strange that these two events that seemed worlds apart were occurring only 3 weeks apart. And I thought, I'm interested in exploring how that could happen and what that meant for American culture at that moment.
You mention in your book that NASA eventually gradually becomes sensitized to some of these broader questions of economic disparities and civil rights issues. And you talk about the attempts by NASA to show that it's socially relevant,
right,
with projects such as Project Breakthrough. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Sure. So in the 1960s, when civil rights activists, but also I talk about feminists and counterculture hippies, but also anti-Vietnam war activists, they were all really quite critical of NASA, demonstrating, protesting. And in the 60s, NASA administrators didn't really have to pay much attention to that grassroots critique because the race to the moon was so popular, right? We had to beat the Russians. But mm-hmm. once we do beat them in the 70s, NASA does have to pay attention because popularity of the space race begins to sort of dwindle, and so does their budget. So during that period, NASA begins to try to figure out ways of spinning off technologies to engage these critiques. And the Operation Breakthrough example that you're talking about was related to civil rights activists and their critique that we were spending all this money, $20 billion, to get to the moon and to, in a sense, house astronauts in space, in space capsules. But we were spending very, very little money, improving living conditions in what was then called the American ghetto. Mm-hmm. So what NASA does is it creates, and I believe it was 1972, it creates an urban systems project office. That office is charged with spinning off technologies to help inner city residents, especially African Americans. And it teams up with HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, to do that. And they begin to try to create technologies to help what was HUD's project then called Operation Breakthrough, which was to try to create efficient, low-cost prefab housing in cities that would help inner city residents. And one technology that NASA attempts to spin off was they took really the really efficient heating and cooling systems that they had developed for the NASA space capsule, the Apollo space capsule, and they actually implement them and transfer them to low-income housing projects. They only do it in one, but it was a pretty interesting attempt to try to take space technology and ground it back on Earth.
How effective was it in?
It's located in Jersey City, near Newark, New Jersey. They only implemented one. I went and visited it. It was efficient. It lowered energy consumption. It lowered costs, but it was very, very costly to maintain. It's basically being held together even today with duct tape because they can't find a lot of parts for it. So what I argue in the book is that it was really more performative than substantive. It was really NASA showing civil rights activists and the public that it was attempting to deal with these issues, but it didn't really change the lives of inner city African Americans at all.
When I read that section of your book, I was thinking about the term spinoff and how, my God, that's such a central structure of NASA's justification for doing all of this work towards human exploration of the planets. This idea that, well, in the process, we don't know how to do it now, but in the process of doing it, we're going to discover all of this amazingly cool practical stuff,
right,
for the world back home. And I was thinking, my God, did that start around Project Breakthrough? Did you run across any discussion of spinoffs in the early part of the 60s when you started this project?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were always, NASA officials, NASA administrators were always trying to defend money being put into space exploration through the concept of a spinoff, and usually not so much scientific knowledge, but more spinoffs that could help people, normal everyday people back on Earth. But I don't think it was as important a concept in the 60s because it was such a popular program to, you know, to get to the moon. I think it was in the 70s when NASA realized that spinoff technology was really its ticket to maintaining popularity and also maintaining its budget. So NASA actually starts publishing a glossy magazine called Spinoff and sending it out to people all over the country to try to sort of highlight a lot of the technologies that they were trying to transfer. So it became increasingly important, I think.
One of the cool things about your book was your discussion of these iconic photographs, Earthrise, the photo of the Earth coming over the horizon of the moon in Apollo 8, and then the blue marble photograph of the whole Earth on Apollo 17, which I guess became the cover of the whole Earth catalog. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those have been talked about as these kind of iconic photographs of the environmental movement, but you seem to be kind of turning them around to look back at NASA itself. How does the environmental movement affect NASA?
I was sort of very surprised by my research on that chapter. It turns out, you know, I'm an environmental historian, and that chapter on the environmental movement and NASA was really the spark for the book. So I thought that would be the first one I would write, but it turned out I wrote it much, much later, partly because I kept finding sort of strange source material that made me rethink my original idea about what those images meant. But to get back to your question, and I'll answer both in my discussion. But the way that I think that NASA influenced the environmental movement, or the way the environmental movement influenced NASA, was early on people like Stuart Brand, you know, an early environmentalist in the 1960s. He really wanted NASA to turn back around and look at Earth, and he wondered why we hadn't had a photograph of the whole Earth yet. So he's tripping on LSD on his rooftop in San Francisco, and he prints up the next day hundreds of buttons asking the simple question, why haven't we seen a picture of the whole Earth yet? And he sends them out to NASA scientists, and 4 years later, 5 years later, all of a sudden administrators are, you know, consciously changing the trajectory of Apollo 17 to get that image.
Huh.
So in that sense, the environmentalists were sort of pushing NASA to think, you know, more environmentally. But what I found so interesting about that photograph was that I had assumed it immediately became an environmental icon. But when I went to do my research online, I found it was just absent from Earth Day celebrations, from, you know, the campaigns of the Sierra Club. And we're talking, you know, the mid-70s, there was no iconography of that image. Huh. So in the book, I make the argument that it had to be made into an environmental icon. And I make the argument that NASA helped do that through a lot of its data gathering on regarding global ecological changes that then get sort of overlaid onto that image. And that slowly that image becomes, in a sense, a green image.
Huh. One other really interesting chapter in your book, it talks about the women's movement and Sally Ride's first flight. You open that chapter with Sally Ride's first flight on the space shuttle in 1983, right, right, and her reception back at the Johnson Space Center. I was wondering if you could talk about that scene.
It's a great scene, and I actually got some pushback on opening that chapter with Sally Ride, but I'm really glad I did, because I think that what she was doing in the event I'm going to describe was just subtle and very, very powerful. So basically, the Challenger is unable to land at Cape Canaveral because of a storm, so they redirect it to land at the Edwards Air Force Base in California. And they land, and the five crew members get off the shuttle. They wave to a small crowd, and then they're immediately whisked to the Johnson Space Center, where there's a homecoming ceremony. And they're on the sort of makeshift stage, and all of a sudden, a NASA protocol officer walks forward with a huge bouquet of carnations and roses, a white and red bouquet. And he's walking right towards Sally Ride. And she looks him squarely in the eye. This is in front of hundreds of people. And she rather subtly shakes her head back and forth, you know, and then he doesn't pay attention. He keeps walking towards her, and she turns her back on him and leaves him standing there awkwardly with this arm full of flowers. And then immediately these NASA administrators rush forward and give flowers to the wives of the other Challenger crewmates, but they have nothing for astronaut Steve Hawley, who was there, and at the time, Sally Ride's husband. And I just use that as a way to talk about her body and women's and men's bodies and how they play a significant role in NASA's defense of the all-male astronaut corps, and then also women activists and how they use the female body to try to force and pressure NASA to begin undertaking medical examinations for women in space, and then finally accepting women into the astronaut corps.
Sally Ride occupies this really interesting place in your story about someone who is so determined, as you write about, to be seen as one of the crew.
Yeah.
To, in a sense, express this idea that there is no difference between her and the other crewmates.
Right.
Simultaneously, she's a rock star and an icon and somebody totally willing to acknowledge her debt to second wave feminism. It's a really interesting kind of juxtaposition. And there's this other interesting juxtaposition that you make between her and difference feminists who are arguing in fact, women are superiorly constructed physiologically, psychologically for spaceflight. Could you talk about that?
Sure. You know, that was the most interesting part about that chapter is, you know, in each chapter, I try to look at how, on the one hand, these grassroots activists are influencing NASA and the space race. So in this case, how feminists were influencing NASA, you know, pushing NASA to accept women as astronauts. But I also, in each chapter, look at the other equation, the other causal relationship, which is how is NASA affecting these movements? And in this chapter, it was sort of the most difficult to find. But what I did find was that this debate over female astronauts within the second wave feminism caused an internal discussion within the movement about women and whether they were equal to men or whether they were different but worthy as well to become astronauts. And this really goes back to 1963 when the Russians launched Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space. And then when she comes down, they use her as an example of equality of the sexes, right?
Yeah.
So you have some feminists embracing that idea, but then you have other feminists saying, no, women are actually quite different than men biologically, and that difference matters, as you just said.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, I had a historian, Emily Gibson, on the show recently, and she was talking about the role of women in commercial airlines. And in particular, she's talking about the role of women air hostesses and how they were used in airline advertising in the 1940s, 1950s, in part to make exotic spaces, you know, African destinations, South American destinations seem exotic but safe.
Right.
And that how those images were used in a way to expand these air empires for Air France and other airlines. I was wondering if you saw some kind of similar role here for NASA, a way of showing that spaceflight had gone from its kind of extreme environment to something that was more habitual, maybe even domestic, or if that did happen, whether NASA was worried about women astronauts giving it that construction.
Well, it's interesting because I think that, you know, I guess I'll reply with a question, then we can keep talking about this because I find it really sort of fascinating. When you think of an astronaut from the 1960s, and if you don't picture them in a spacesuit in space, what comes into your head?
Oh, God. I imagine them in the test planes, actually.
Okay, good. They're flying their rockets, or they're driving their really fast Corvettes, yeah, or their cars. Yeah. Or they're drinking hard, or that's how NASA presented these men, as these virile sort of supermen in a way.
Right.
And I think that women astronauts were a threat to that brand, right? You know, these virile spacemen. I mean, the first press conference where NASA introduces the America's first astronauts, there was one reporter who said it felt more like a beauty pageant than anything else, because they were these tanned men, very muscular. They all were sort of, sort of performing up there in front of the press corps. And I think that people like Sally Ride and the other women pilots who were trying to be astronauts in the very, very early years, even in the 1960s, very much threatened that. And I don't think that NASA ever really embraced the notion that spaceflight could be domestic. You know, there was a lot of pushback and questions about, for instance, Sally Ride's or women astronauts on the space shuttle. Where would they sleep? Where would they go to the bathroom? It was not presented as something that was a casual, easy thing to do. And I think that that's partly because the women who were involved didn't want to be perceived that way. Sally Ride refused to be photographed performing any of the sort of common duties on the space shuttle, such as cooking, cleaning, which all the astronauts shared those duties, but she would not be photographed doing those things because she assumed that then that would be taken as a evidence that she was basically, the den mother up, yeah, on the space shuttle. So I don't think it ever went domestic like the Jetsons. You know what I mean? I think that it was very much protected a little bit more.
There's this interesting dilemma that you paint towards the end of your book in talking about the culture of NASA, which really has its roots in this conservative, all-male, as you put it, virile culture of military men, test pilots, and then the engineers who are building the craft, the spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously, NASA has to become sensitive to this counterculture, which the people of which look so different, and they're interested in such social and environmental ideas. How does NASA end up making it through this?
It's interesting because in all the other chapters, so there's chapters on civil rights, Vietnam, environmentalism, and then second wave feminism. And in each of those chapters, NASA eventually comes around to trying to engage those movements. The last chapter looks at both the hippie counterculture and the new right, the conservative movement, in one chapter. And it's sort of a chapter about the battle over NASA. And whereas the counterculture very much rejects NASA as part of that military-industrial complex, they really want to focus on things like inner space rather than outer space. They really reject that. The new right, the sort of rising conservative movement, really embraces NASA as a sign of, the free market. They look at the aerospace industry as a symbol of free market democracy when it's compared to the Soviet Union. You have people like Ayn Rand and William F. Buckley coming out in support of it. And that battle really plays out. And in that chapter, NASA does not try to appease the hippies. NASA, I believe, very much sides with the new right and plays into that movement and relies on that movement more than it does the hippies.
I was also thinking when I read that chapter about an interview I ran recently with Valerie Olson, who's a space anthropologist at University of California. And she talks about how, NASA is so rich with this language of the frontier, and making these explicit links back to the 19th century frontier thesis and a lot of stuff that a lot of progressives kind of freak out about.
Right.
And yet when she talks to engineers themselves about their work, kind of moving away from the rhetoric, but just to what kind of work do they do to keep humans alive in the space shuttle or in the International Space Station, they talk almost obsessively about environment.
Yeah.
And she even has this great quote from this engineer. He's like, it's environment, environment, environment. That's everything that we do.
I wish I had had that quote. I would have put it in my book. It's a great quote.
But it seemed to me like, wow, there's a kind of stealth environmental thinking within
absolutely
these kinds of, you know, fairly, as you said, buttoned up, conservative. Yeah. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most interesting things I found when I was looking at, you know, sort of the construction of the Apollo space capsule, this is in the 1960s, was that it wasn't so stealth, as you said, this interest in the environment. As a matter of fact, NASA hired one of the most famous ecologists of the period, Eugene Odom, to help them think about designing the early space capsules for these astronauts. And he did several experiments where he tried to create his own capsules, enclosed ecosystems that would grow, in this case, plankton and other types of flora to not only create food for astronauts, but also to clean the air within the cabins.
Yeah.
And to also provide, you know, clean water and things like that. So NASA was very much involved in that in the early years, but engineers argued that it would be too expensive and it would take up too much room to transport those environments into space, and that they could basically do it through technology more efficiently. So I think that notion had been around within NASA from the beginning, but got sort of pushed to the side in the push to get people alive to the moon.
You mentioned at the beginning of your book that so many environmental histories focus on a particular set of subjects, national parks and environmental policy and pollution, and that you were hoping to apply this kind of environmental thinking to subjects outside of that, particularly Apollo.
Right.
And that simultaneously, people who do study Apollo, these kinds of histories of the space age, have for a long time tended to focus a little too much on technology,
yeah,
the kind of deterministic quality of technology as the driver, I guess, of space history.
Right.
And so I was wondering if you could talk both about your interest in situating your book that way, and also if you see, now that you've completed it, other areas that you think we need to work on to how to apply this to other kinds of questions.
Sure. So I think that what happens in academia or in any sort of field is that we become siloed off, right, from the rest of culture or the rest of history. And it's happened in environmental history where in the early years of the field, people, as you said, wrote about parks and pollution and not much else. And other historians didn't really pay attention because it didn't involve things like the Civil War or the Great Depression, right? And within space history, people did tend to talk about the technology or perhaps the administrators. And again, people outside that field weren't really paying attention either. And I was just sort of, I was tired of speaking at my conferences to 50 other people. And I thought, how do we broaden this out and make this about bigger, broader issues? So the book was originally going to be just about NASA and environmentalism, but I thought that was too narrow. So I pushed further to try to engage what I saw as the real important political context of that era. And I did that by bringing in these other movements, you know, civil rights, anti-Vietnam War, counterculture, the new right. And I think it's it's a much bigger, broader book. Now there are pitfalls in that as well, because you're open to much more criticism by a much broader group of people. But it was just it was the kind of book I wanted to write at this point in my career. I didn't want to write a narrow book. And to give you an example of something else I think we need to do, I'm thinking about a new project on looking at the urban crisis of the 1960s, riots occurring in places like Newark, New Jersey, Watts, and Los Angeles, and really thinking about that, of course, as a racial and economic problem. But there were also a lot of environmental issues going on, whether it's poor and unhealthy living conditions, no access to outdoor recreation, pollution-strewn streets. There's an environmental component to those crises that I think has not been thought about. So it's an example of an environmental historian not just thinking about parks and pollution, but thinking about a bigger event in U.S. history and how it might have been influenced by our relationship to the natural environment, including the natural environment of cities.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was thinking when I when I saw how you positioned this of some other kind of space related projects. I was just thinking this week about Opportunity, the Martian rover, and how it's it seems to have given up the ghost. They can't contact it anymore. What I was following online on Twitter was just how incredibly sad these communities of people are, and how we sometimes think about robotics based exploration as being divorced from so many of the issues that we attach to human space exploration, but in fact, it's incredibly human.
I totally agree.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the point you just made is really one of the most surprising feelings I had about doing this book, was that I sort of thought that when I started this book, that it was going to be a book that was quite critical of these attempts to put a man on the moon, to beat the Russians, this sort of Cold War battle going on. And I thought, you know, why were they going to the moon? I guess at that point in the research, very, very early, I was identifying more with those hippies up in Woodstock.
Yeah.
But then as I read the reminiscences of people, whether it was people on the street or administrators at NASA or engineers or scientists or even the astronauts, you realize that this attempt and the moon landing ultimately had a really important existential impact. You could almost say a spiritual impact on the people at the time. And I realized that it was quite important and that it was quite valid. And it made it much more complex for me. It made it not just about putting nuts and bolts on the moon, and more about what does this country and what do we as the human race really want to do, and how do we want to think about exploration, but also ourselves. It was pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the Mars rover, you know, going dead, as they called it, they used the word dead in the newspaper, and people feeling emotion about that. I think that's a similar existential connection to something bigger out there that's important.
Yeah. Neil Marr, thank you so much for talking with me.
Michael, it was really fantastic. Thanks a lot.
That's it for today. The music was composed by Zabrat. Make sure you check out the Time to Eat the Dogs website for podcast links and other exploration-related stuff. And if you get the chance, please take a minute to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps make the show visible to new listeners. And if you want to recommend a guest or make a comment, feel free to contact me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. See you next week.